Nothing lights us up more than helping people grow their wealth through multifamily investing in a way that actually feels good and makes sense where they are right now. That's exactly why we created the Where Am I Now Multifamily Assessment.
Here's the thing, no two journeys ever look the same. Maybe you're just starting out and simply curious about what's possible. Maybe you're dipping your toes into your really first passive investment, or maybe you're craving that behind the scenes peek at how it all works.
You might even be gearing up to go big and acquire your first deal, or ready to scale your portfolio to new heights by teaming up with strong partners who can help you grow like never before.
Instead of tossing you one size fits all advice, boring and not helpful, this assessment zooms in on your exact stage of growth.
It helps us get to know your goals, your challenges, and what gets you most excited about building wealth through multifamily investing, so we can hand over the tools, resources, and support that actually moves the needle for you.
The best part? It only takes a few minutes, but the clarity you walk away with, that's the magic. Think of it as your roadmap to what's next.
Ready? Head to kittysisters.com/whereaminow to get started. That's kittysisters.com/whereaminow.
We slept on the ground on a mattress at night, and my parents worked there during the day. I hope that they see me as like a leader. I think that in my family, you know, I was always taught to kind of not stand out too much. 20-year-old Asian girl, I looked like I was like 12 years old. While I was at UCLA, I saw Million Dollar Listing, the reality TV show. I went kind of full steam ahead, and I almost had like no choice but to succeed. So I think that definitely drove me more to prove my parents wrong.
Yeah.
But if no one that looks like you stands up and speaks up, then your views are not being reflected.
Everyone sees 30 under 30. No one sees the lap floor she slept on in China. People love the highlight reel. 30 under 30, youngest president of the Asian Real Estate Association of America, brokerage owner, policy advocate. But that's not where the story starts. It started on a mattress on a floor of structural engineering lab in Nanjing with parents, PhD engineers, waiting for the US government to assign them housing. With a 2-year-old left behind with grandparents while her parents chase a scholarship to America. It continues in a 1-bedroom studio in Long Beach, California, saving every dollar for a first home in Irvine. And with a 20-year-old Asian girl who looked 12 getting rejected while trying to sell million-dollar homes. This episode isn't about real estate. It's about ownership. Ownership of property. Ownership of your career. Ownership of your voice. Because one home didn't just change her family's address. It changed their trajectory. Let's start from the beginning.
Hey, we're Palmy and Nancy Kitty, the Kitty Sisters, and we're here to help you turn earned income into own income and build what actually lasts.
From a $2,000 bank accounts to nearly $500 million in real estate assets, earning our way into rooms we once never thought we belong in. Along the way, we learn success isn't just about making it, it's about making it last.
Here we share money, real estate, and investing strategies, but more importantly, we talk about the systems and decisions that create legacy, certainty, and continuity.
If you value speed, convenience, and execution certainty, and if you're building not just for yourself, but for the generations after you, you're in the right place.
This is the first of the family podcast. So Jamie, let's start from the beginning. Before the home ownership, before winning the 30 under 30 award, before being the youngest president of the Asian Real Estate Association of America, take us back to the beginning. What was your journey like? I know you have a very unique perspective as well. With the Kitty Sisters, we're really intentional about showing other Asian American families what's possible and that they can turn their earned income into own income mm-hmm. and create generational freedom for themselves.
Absolutely.
So your parents were structural engineering students in China getting their doctorate. And I know at the time policies was such that they weren't able to own their own home. Can you walk us through what that was like, what life was like, and what was home for you then?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born in China. And like you mentioned, at that time, my parents were professors at a university mm-hmm. in Nanjing, and they're both civil engineers and they worked at a structural engineering lab. And as you had mentioned, you know, at the time, the policies in China didn't really allow for you to purchase or even rent a home. You kind of had to be assigned it by the government, and it happened based on seniority. You know, you kind of have to wait your turn in that process. So although they were professors at the university, they didn't have a place to live. So they lived at the structural engineering lab where they worked during the day. So that's where I was born. And we slept on the ground on a mattress at night, and my parents worked there during the day, but they didn't really know when would be that opportunity where we could actually finally have our own home, whether to rent it, to buy it. And, you know, they always had that American dream. They've heard of the American dream of home ownership. And so they decided to take the leap of faith and move to America where they could, you know, build a foundation for our family and achieve that homeownership dream. So my parents decided to apply for their PhDs in America. And they kind of just applied to all different universities and PhD programs around America to see where they could get a scholarship. Because that was really the only way they could afford to get it. And the school had to kind of support them and get the student visa, right? So my mom ended up getting accepted to the University of Pittsburgh first. So she set off by herself and left my dad and I behind in Nanjing. And then a few months later, my dad got accepted to the University of Oklahoma. So he went there. And then I stayed behind with my grandparents for two more years in China while my parents were kind of just like getting settled, doing their PhD programs. And so it was kind of a lot for our family because we had to be, my parents were away from each other and away from me. We were all in different places, but it was like a sacrifice that they wanted to take to get to America. And everything was for that kind of homeownership dream. So that's kind of how we immigrated to the United States and the reason why we did.
How old were you when they left?
So I was 2 years old when they left. And then I was 4 and a half when I came to the United States. And when I moved here, I first moved to Norman, Oklahoma, where my dad was going to OU. So that was definitely culture shock. And then our family, eventually, after both of my parents graduated, we moved to California.
So when you were living in Oklahoma, your mom stayed in Pittsburgh. So you guys really didn't see each other very much.
Yeah, my parents, you know, after 2 years, 2 and a half years, they were on their last year of their PhD program, like finishing up.
They were very smart.
Said to have my grandparents and I come.
Oh, your grandparents came as
well. Yeah, so they kind of came with me for the first year. And then we lived with my dad in Oklahoma for a year before, you know, when they both graduated, we ended up all moving as a family to California. My grandparents went back, yeah.
That's so amazing. Like, that's a lot of sacrifice that the entire family had to do. Not just your parents being apart from each other, but even the grandparents had to be involved in raising you basically for a few years.
Yeah, for sure.
That's amazing. So when you came to California, I know that originally you lived in an apartment in Long Beach together.
Yes.
And then after a few years, your parents were able to get the home in Irvine. I know that home has very sentimental meaning to you because basically the city, you met your husband there growing up in high school, and then you also grew up in that home. Like, can you talk about what that home means for you?
Yeah. So my parents, you know, we lived in Long Beach for a few years. They saved every penny. You know, we lived in a one bedroom studio apartment. We kind of just shared that space. And obviously they saved every single penny to try to buy a home. And then my mom wanted to buy a home in Irvine where, you know, she was like, they have good schools there. So we bought our first home and it really changed the trajectory of our life. It was the first time, you know, before that, every year or two, I moved. I moved around China. I moved into Oklahoma. I moved to Long Beach and I was always at a new school making new friends. But finally, we bought that home. I finally had stability and I stayed in the same city for many years. I made friends, you know, really good lifelong friends. And then I met my husband, Jason, in high school. And that home not only was a place for us to live and build our foundation, but, you know, it started our family's wealth building journey. And we started building equity in the home. Mm-hmm. We put our blood, sweat and tears into fixing it up and making it nice. And as the property value went up, we realized that's like an opportunity to use that money for other opportunities as well. So, you know, when I went to college at UCLA, when my sister went to Yale and now she's at USC Medical School, my parents were able to afford all of those very expensive tuitions. Yeah. Obviously, they were able to refinance their homes and take some money of the equity out to help support us through college, which obviously I myself and I know my sister will be forever grateful. And then, you know, start building equity and pull it out to buy the next property and then turn the first house into an investment property and whatnot. So I think that homeownership journey for us was not just like our lives, but just really transformed everything for us. And then eventually when I got into real estate, I think like everything became really tied together and that gave me my why and my reason for everything that I do today.
That is so amazing. It's like one property, but like,
it's like a cash
cow. It's like a, yeah, it's like a money tree, right? Like, cause it's like, and it's like, it spawned like you going to college. But it also like the impact that it has is like that journey that you're going on. It's not just for you. It's like everyone else that you impact. It was because of that home.
Right.
Kind of like it's like the beginning of this, like the greatness that is now Jamie, you know, and your family are very smart people. I know. And it's like that home, that one, like I just think of like a money pot. It's just like
this catapult that got us to the next level. Yeah.
So like when you were at UCLA, you studied environmental science.
Yes.
And at the same time, I think culturally there was expectations of what you should become.
Yeah.
Talk a little about what that was like. What were your parents expecting your career choices to be?
Yeah. Well, as I had mentioned, my parents are both PhDs in civil engineering. So they're obviously very studious, and they always wanted me to do something that's like, you know, very stable and is going to give a good income. So they always recommended engineering, medicine, or law. Like one of the big three, you know, you have to go to another graduate school, get a degree and have a better base at least. And, you know, I thought at first that I was going to go into environmental engineering, which is why I chose environmental science. And I just wasn't like really that interested in that topic. And then medicine wasn't really for me either. So I was like, okay, well, I like talking to people. I like, you know, even debating and things like that. So I was like, maybe I'll do law. So I ended up working at a law firm during college for a few years, just interning and just kind of seeing what it's like. And I almost like felt like it was only like A, B, or C. And I just chose the one that made the most sense. So I did like all my LSATs and I applied to law school, and I was fully on planning to go. I did everything that I had to do to like get there. But then I decided to get my real estate license. And actually, it's kind of like a funny story. Like I always was interested in real estate just because I thought like, you know, home ownership was so amazing. And I always wanted to like, but I never thought I would become a real estate agent. Yeah. But while I was at UCLA, I saw Million Dollar Listing, the reality TV show, for the first time on Bravo. And then it was funny because like the agents were selling homes literally like outside of UCLA's campus right there. And I would go out to lunch, and then I would like go to the grocery store. I would see their open house signs. And I'm like, this is crazy. It's happening like literally outside my door. And I was like, it seems so fun and interesting. And I was like, well, maybe I'll just get my license and have it like on the side, you know, while I go to law school, and maybe I'll use it for something, or even use it for myself, or help my parents, you know, and family friends. So I got my license. I kind of dove into it, but I sold a couple of houses pretty quickly right away before I even graduated. Like I was only 20 years old.
Wow.
And so at that time I was like, wow, I love this. I was like, I love making money. I love talking to people. It's exciting. It's not boring. I don't have to sit in like a cubicle and read briefs or like, you know, things all day. So I was like, I told my parents, like, I don't think I want to go to law school anymore. I want to try to be a real estate agent. And they were like, oh, no. Like, definitely not. You know, that's like not stable. Most real estate agents don't make a lot. Like, even though the ones on TV make a lot of money, most of them don't. And to them, they were like, you're going to become a salesperson when you could, you know, have a more honorable, legitimate job or profession. So, but I was like, no, I'm like really passionate about this. Let me just kind of do this for a year or two and see what happens.
Yeah.
So finally, they were like, okay, fine, you're on your own. We're not going to financially support you or anything. You have to pay for all your own apartment and car and everything. But they were like, I guess, you know, worst case scenario, you could still go to law school in 2 or 3 years if you have to. They're like, even though we think it's going to be a huge waste of time, you know? And I went kind of full steam ahead, and I almost had like no choice but to succeed. So I think that definitely drove me more to prove my parents wrong.
Yeah.
And then I started selling more homes. So I just never turned back, really.
What mindset did you have to go from like law to like real estate? Like, that's a big transition.
Yeah.
How did that work?
Like, who do you have to become along the way? And what was that mindset shift that totally changed your life trajectory?
Yeah. I don't even know, honestly. Like, I think that I never thought that I was like a perfect fit for going into law. I just thought like, you know, I didn't want to disappoint my parents. I want to do something that they're proud of. But I think I realized like, I really like interacting with people, talking to people, and I hate doing like the same thing every day from like, you know, the same schedule every day from 9 to 5 and sitting in the same office and going to the same place every day. So I just realized like, I'm much more excited to wake up in the morning when every day is different. Yeah. And, you know, I'm problem solving, and sometimes it's frustrating, but at least keeps me going.
Maybe you can share it with us. Like, what are some of the things that big challenges that you face professionally that you had to overcome where you may have doubt, like, hey, should I go back to law school?
Yeah.
Or was there any moment like that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially when I first started, I was 20 years old. So as you can imagine, as a 20-year-old Asian girl, I looked like I was like 12 years old, you know,
trying to sell
very young looking, trying to sell million-dollar homes. So I think the age thing was like a huge factor. But I realized eventually that not everyone cares about my age, right? So I mean, like, although I faced a lot of rejection from clients at the beginning, they were like, you're way too young, way too inexperienced. My son is way older than you, and I couldn't imagine them helping me, you know. But then I just tried to remain super professional, answer the questions, be as factual and helpful as I can. Yeah. Eventually one person trusted me, and a second person, and a third person, and as I got experience under my belt, obviously I was able to build up that track record. But I think definitely that was the biggest obstacle, is like, you know, most people when they go into real estate, they have a network or a sphere of influence to tap into. At least your first couple of deals you can do with your friends and family. My friends were in college, right? No one could even barely afford to rent an apartment. And, you know, my family friends, didn't know if I could help them yet either. They didn't know if I had any skills. So
you don't have the track record yet.
Yeah.
So like, okay, one of the interesting thing is like the rejection piece, because a lot of people, they have such fear of rejection that they don't actually take action. Obviously, like you getting rejected by like people who are like, hey, can I sell your house? And they're like, hey, I no, for whatever reason. Like, how did you overcome that?
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning, I think experiencing rejection from clients was overwhelming and I would get like very down on myself, and it would take me like hours or days to get over it. But then I realized finally that I'm really just wasting my time. And I learned to just almost like not be cold, but just not even think about it. Just move on, disconnect. So I don't let it affect my personal life or my personal emotions or my day to day. And real estate is just a numbers game, just like, you know, any other sales. So really, when somebody is not connecting with you, they're not the right fit for to be your client anyway.
Yeah.
So it's better to just move on and not worry about it. If there's a lesson to be learned, of course, absolutely learn the lesson and improve. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the time, it's just not a good fit because you have to really connect with the client, and yeah, not everyone is meant to work with each other.
And like, so you mentioned that you started during your college, like your real estate investing journey. So how did you find like where time was limited and your energy was limited? How did you find, or what do you find like where you should focus on?
I mean, that's for a real estate agent, you really need to spend most of your time on meeting new prospects. So I think like, of course, at the beginning, you have to learn all the skills that you need. But I think a lot of agents that only do like a few transactions a year get very caught up in each transaction. Mm-hmm. But really, like once you win the transaction and the client, you need to be moving on to find the next client mm-hmm. all the time, every day. So that's what you should be spending the majority of your time on, like finding out what's going to be next in your pipeline rather than obsessing over what's currently happening, which is important too. But yeah.
So you were able to really manage your time quite well while you were in school and still getting clients and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think I front loaded my classes a lot to the first couple of years. So my last year was pretty light in terms of class load. And then I had been working at the law firm for like 20 hours a week. So I quit that job. So I had some extra time.
Wow. You're overachiever. Yeah, I'll be like, the time can be like used to selling.
I don't know. Because like, I guess in college, I took like, you know, 3 or 4 classes a semester. I worked 20 hours a week at the law firm. I was taking like LSAT classes and everything. So I mean, like once you figure it out, there's actually a lot of time in the week.
So like when now you have, I think like 20-30 people that work under you, like yeah. A lot of them are probably like agents.
Yes.
Like that. So how do you give them the encouragement? Because like you said, there's a lot of agents, but only a few of them actually make real money. Like how do you encourage people to stick with it?
Yeah. Well, I think that the problem for agents isn't like that they don't want to do it, but it's a lack of consistency. Like I think most agents have the motivation and of course they want to make money and do deals, but it is really hard to wake up every day when you're self-employed mm-hmm. and be consistent. And there's no one to check in with you and say, hey, did you finish your task for today? You don't clock in and clock out. So it's easy to just, you know, if somebody's like distracting you with another, let's go do something fun or do this, you're like, okay, I mean, I guess I could, right? And it's easy to let the day go by. So I think it's, I encourage them to really like choose a couple of things that they enjoy doing to generate business and then really stick to a consistent schedule and do it. And I think as a team, it's important for us to like build our culture. And so we do a lot of like team bonding activities and we do a lot of like social media marketing. So we'll do like content days together and just make content together and try to make things a little bit more fun and interesting so that they can also, you know, bond with each other and rely on each other as well.
Do you think there is some like attributes from like the, because a lot of Asians are entrepreneur, right? So do you think there are Asian kind of type of attributes that helps people be better entrepreneurs or like stay with it more?
Yeah, definitely. I think it helps to be like extroverted or at least pretend to be like, you have to be out there meeting people, talking to people and building relationships. And I think especially it's going to become more and more important in this world of AI where we lose that personal connection. And a lot of things will be able to be replaced by AI, but like human connection will never be able to be replaced. And that's like what we have left mm-hmm. in sales and business and entrepreneurship. And I think that's like the most important part is being able to explain yourself, being able to connect with people, being able to enunciate what you mean, you know?
So in looking back at your real estate investing journey, what has compounding created for your life since then? How real estate has changed your life?
Yeah.
Since you started it.
Yeah. Well, I think real estate has changed my life in so many different ways. Obviously, not only have I built a career, but now I'm obviously a brokerage owner and I own my own company and leaped into kind of entrepreneurship, which I think isn't something that my family really taught, right? My family always taught to take the safe route, kind of. And I think that obviously it led me to my leadership journey as well, especially at ARIA, the Asian Real Estate Association of America, where I served as the national president for 2 years. And I realized that, like, you know, my career in real estate isn't just about selling homes and building wealth, but it's actually about helping other families learn how to change their life through real estate. And so I think it has given me more of my reason to continue what I'm doing and then give my time back as well. So besides for my work at the Asian Real Estate Association, I also hold leadership roles at the National Association of Realtors, the California Association of Realtors, and also the Greater LA Association of Realtors. And obviously, those are volunteer jobs. So I'm not getting paid for them, but they're important to me because I realized that, like, as a leader in the industry, I have a voice. And, you know, when all of these leaders in the government are making our policies that affect, you know, our clients in terms of, you know, the ways that they can invest, tenants' rights, property rights, you know, ways that you can have more people access homeownership. These are all things that we can change through policy. But if no one that looks like you stands up and speaks up, then your views are not being reflected. And so that's why it's something that I'm really passionate about. I spend a significant amount of my time working for these policies because it's things that helps my profession as a realtor, but also all of my clients, homeowners and investors as well.
Can you speak to some of the policies that you see impacting specifically like the Asian Pacific community?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the AANHPI community is very diverse, right? They're Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islanders, over 55 ethnicities, and they speak over like 100 different languages and dialects. So I think like they often get generalized into being thought of as like crazy rich Asians, and they have all cash and they own a bunch of properties. But there's definitely like a lot of minority communities that have very low homeownership rates. And a lot of the times it's lack of education, lack of language resources. So even something that we fought for at ARIA was like, you know, in the U.S. Census, for example, prior to 2013, I think is the year, they did not even have a section for Asian Americans. We were just other. So like, we don't even know how many of us exist. How can you like...
That's 2013?
Yeah. And very recently, these kind of data, like just disaggregating data and finding out what's going on in each community is so important. And it helps create the bills that can, you know, help more families qualify for mortgages and gain homeownership. And then besides for that, like property rights, tenants' rights, you know, in California, for example, I'm sure you guys know that we have pretty terrible like tenants' rights, right? I mean, like good for tenants, really bad for investors. And, you know, there's constantly being bills introduced that make this more difficult for even small mom and pop investors. And so like, these are things that realtors, we go out and advocate for to make sure that our investors are protected and not make it so that California becomes a place where you don't even want to invest anymore because it's too strict or, you know, whatever.
So like a lot of your clients, not only are they buying their own personal residence, but you're also seeing a lot of them buying investment properties, right?
Of course, yeah.
So like, how do they typically, I don't know if you would know this, but like, what do you see as their view on having rental properties? Is this something that a lot of them like try to like really make sure that's part of their portfolio?
Yeah. I mean, I think it just depends. I work with lots of different types of investors. Some of them do like more of a fix and flip where they flip it right away and sell it for a profit or rebuild, you know, buy land and rebuild, versus some are more building their portfolio and trying to get more units and doors and renting it out like long term. We even have clients that buy and rent short term and do like Airbnb, vacation rentals, because that way you have, you know, different tax write-offs and different ways to generate more monthly income with a little bit more work and risk. So it really just depends on your risk appetite and what makes most sense to you. But I think it always makes sense to diversify, of course.
So Jamie, do you think anyone can be an investor?
Absolutely, yes. I think that everyone should be an investor. And I think that the most important thing to invest in is yourself. I think, you know, everyone has potential, but if they don't believe in themselves and invest in themselves, then they probably can't reach that potential. And of course, it helps to have people around you that encourage you and support you. But yeah.
You know, like when I was at your national convention in
Santa Monica
last year, what I was really surprised by was one of the stats that was presented on stage. And it talked about how Asian family, once they start like the first few decades after home ownership, their net worth rises. Mm-hmm. And I believe like after the fourth decade, it drops in half.
Mm.
In doing more research in that, I discovered like a lot of times it's because the lack of like we come here with like a certain amount of fuel on our tank.
Yeah.
They use a lot of grit and hustle to get to where they are. But once law changes, market condition changes, due to language barrier, maybe lack of resources, they're not able to pivot as well. And their wealth literally half, while other races, their wealth may not have climbed as fast in some groups, but it's sustained. And I think like having groups like yours as like an advocate for policy changes to help that kind of those scenarios don't happen as much is really important.
Yeah.
Do you see like some of the things that I know that you also have like your organization also meet with congressional leaders. Mm-hmm. To push for policies. How is that process like?
So basically each year, once a year, we have all of our leaders from around the country. We come to meet together to do our policy summit, and we schedule meetings with our local congressional leaders from our district, because the senators and congressmen, they love talking to people from their district because you're their voters and they care actually about what you think. And so we actually go make an appointment with them, visit them on the Hill. Each year we choose three policies that we find to be very, very important that year. And we explain to them why we feel it's important, not just for realtors, but for homeowners in your district. Mm-hmm. And that way, when they're out there voting on these bills, they understand the local community's perspective. And the realtor group is actually like an extremely powerful lobbying group. It's one of the biggest it's not the biggest lobbying group in the country. We spend a lot of money on advocacy work. And so when the realtors come to the Hill is what they say, the policymakers, they listen and they know. It's like it's a big deal. So it's exciting to be able to be involved on that level and actually meet the local leaders who are making those votes and decisions. And over the years, we actually build close relationships with them so that, even on the local level, there's local policies and state policies. And when there's things that we need support from, we can, contact them and ask for their help.
Wow, that's really quite amazing. Like thinking about like where you started and like now being like an advocate, it's like pretty kind of interesting, because it's like using sort of like your persuasion and things that you would have done as a lawyer to like become advocate for all these causes. Like I know that in California, we are not the most landlord friendly. Mm-hmm. And like, how do your clients navigate kind of like that balance? Like, of course, like I feel like tenant rights is important, but at the same time, you need to balance it with people who pay rent on time because a lot of times I think the perception is that there are these like multinational corporations who own these real estate, but majority of US rental properties are owned by mom and pop.
Yes.
Like, what type of policy changes do you think needs to happen in order to sort of strike a balance where we encourage people to continue to invest so that there's new updated units for people to rent in California?
I think that it's important, of course, to have like tenants' rights. Like tenants should not be unfairly displaced out of their homes and forced to leave unfairly without notice and whatnot. But I think like what needs to end is squatters' rights.
Right. Yes.
Squatters' rights is terrible.
Why that even exists. Makes no sense.
You know, it's a very archaic thing from the original, when the settlers first came to the United States and no one claimed the land and there was no one to take care of the land. But it's ridiculous that a squatter can come into your house, stay for a certain amount of days, and now you can't get them out as the homeowner. And it's ridiculous that you can't just call the police and the police can't come and just escort these people out of your home. I mean, this is absolutely not acceptable to me. I don't understand why anyone would ever support that. So that's like a bill that's been kind of introduced recently, and we're definitely watching it and trying to support that. But yeah, I mean, I think like landlords, right? Landlords, maybe I agree with landlords not being able to price gouge or even having a limit to the amount that they can raise the rent each year. Those are all like totally fair, and it makes sense as long as they're able to, raise it with inflation and increase it. Most landlords don't want to increase the rent if they have a good tenant. Mm-hmm. But if you have a bad tenant who's breaking the lease, or they're not paying anymore, or they even broke into your house while it was vacant, you need to have the ability to kick these people out. And it shouldn't be a long court process that you have to go through, eviction. It should be easier to do.
Yeah, squatter rights sounds like an oxymoron, right?
Right, exactly.
When we were flipping houses in LA, one of the things I was always like so scared of is like some random person going to come and sleep in it while we're flipping.
Actually, hire security.
Yeah, and actually someone did do it. It was so scary. Like, apparently, like, they came and slept in our tub.
What?
Yeah, it was, we're flipping. And then, like, he was in a wheelchair, an electric wheelchair. And he didn't, and it ran out of battery.
So he couldn't.
So he couldn't leave.
Oh, no.
And then our contractor not only charged it for him, gave him $20.
Well, it's like, what are you supposed to do?
And they're like, he can't leave. So he literally, I was like.
The moment why we got the security at fire. Yeah, officer, like, oh, no.
Can't do this.
Like, what's happening? He was like, I had a charger. He can't. I can't even get him out.
Yeah, literally, you had to charge him. And then, like, that same property, the day we closed, that morning, the neighbor called and said, someone's sleeping on your porch.
Was it the same guy?
It wasn't the same guy. But I was like, well, technically, it's not my house anymore.
Because it's closed.
He already closed. But I'm like, yeah, that was one of the worst fear, especially like where we were flipping houses. I was like, oh. So we'd make friends with the neighbors. We put in alarm systems and it'll be like, he'll call and say like, hey, and I'll call like, hey, Ed, the alarm went off. And he's like kind of like a neighborhood watch guy. So he'll just like, don't worry, I got this. But he was
nephews.
My grandson, he's only 13, but he's like 5'10". Go over. I'm like, okay, be careful. Go, like, I'm at home. I'm like, okay, Ed, be careful. Go check it out for me. And he's like, yeah, it's fine. But yeah, that's like one of the worst fear. I think like working hard, having a home, owning it, you have the right to use it as you want. You live in it, rent it out, but you shouldn't have to subsidize some random person wanting to break in and live in it.
Right. Absolutely.
So Jamie, let's talk about looking forward 5 years from now.
Yeah.
What are you looking to optimize and what are you going to stop like chasing?
You know, I think that as I am in, I've been in this business for 14 years now, and the longer that I'm in it, I realize that like my time to myself is more and more valuable. So I really like enjoy working with the clients that are not toxic and that enjoy my help. I don't want to work with people that necessarily are, you know, I call them toxic. I basically like, you know, fire clients sometimes if they're not a good fit for me, you know? And sometimes it's like, if I feel like I'm giving you good advice and you're not listening to it, I don't feel like I can help you anymore, then I just don't want to waste my time. So I think like I'm doing so many different roles and jobs and helping out all my agents and trying to still build my life. So I think I have to just be very careful with not being around time suckers.
So you're being more selective with who you take on.
Yeah. And also like, I think I'm learning to say no too, because I think that I ended up in all of these volunteer roles and everything that I am very passionate about. I want to continue doing, but sometimes I do have a problem saying no, and people ask me to do things and I always say yes, 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 and then I realize like I only have 24 hours a day, and you know, I'm gonna run out of time sooner or later.
Oh my gosh, yeah, you do have a lot of hats you're wearing. That's pretty amazing. It's crazy. So like I think we all feel really passionate that real estate is one of the best vehicle to build generational wealth. Like, where do you see that? Like, are you seeing that people recognize that it is a tool, or are they getting trapped in like the next shiny thing, like, oh, crypto going up, yeah. I need to go, you know, that's building wealth. Like, this is a slow and steady process, but do you see there's still a lot of people who's passionate about using this as a vehicle?
Yeah, I think that, you know, people are definitely still passionate about real estate. And most people still know that real estate is like one of the safest long-term plays that you can invest in, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of families are realizing, unfortunately, with like inflation and the way that the world is going, that like the housing prices are going up faster than inflation and salaries and, you know, how much income can catch up.
Yeah.
And so I think I have a lot of clients and families that are like trying to invest and buy homes that they're for their kids, you know, even now, and whether their kids will live in it one day or use it to help pay for college, yeah, or, you know, use it as a additional income with a rental property. They're trying to get in their foot in the door as soon as possible for their kids. I do think that there are, unfortunately, like some of the younger generation out there who feels like it's hopeless, and maybe they don't have that. They don't have the generational wealth. Their parents didn't, unfortunately, set them up. Mm-hmm. And they now feel like no matter what I do, it's like hopeless. So now they're like, some of these people are like, maybe I'll strike it rich in crypto, or, you know, I don't know what these kids are doing these days, OnlyFans. But whatever it takes to get it to make it.
Actually, I learned recently that you can get an EB1 visa if you have a large enough OnlyFan following.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
And how?
You just apply, like, what do they call, special skills or something? You have to have a special talent.
It's like they normally give it to like scientists, yes, and artists, yes, but you know,
boy, but
OnlyFans is an artist.
If you have if your revenue is high enough and you have enough followings, but like that's, but you know what you said is really interesting, and I really want the audience to sort of pay attention to this. Like, you could have gone the traditional safe route, mm-hmm, and you chose not to. And I think a lot of younger generations, Gen Z, Gen whatever, Gen Alpha, whatever it is now, I think people people are struggling because they see the traditional way of making money and having a living is not sustainable and they're frustrated. But you buck the trend and you're one of the proof that says that, hey, be creative and you don't have to follow the traditional school route, get a degree in some field that makes a whole bunch of money and then like go get stuck in a cubicle for 40 years. I think like your example should show proof like if you're creative enough, you're able to make money regardless of, yes, you're doing real estate, but someone else could have chosen something else as well in today's economy.
Yeah. I think it's always important to think outside the box and stand out. I mean, even when I first started in real estate at that time, people like were very traditional in the way that they did real estate. So when I joined a real estate brokerage, my office manager told me like, go door knock, go hit the streets, cold call. That's how you get business, right? And then no one really used social media at the time. So I started using the internet to generate leads. Uh-huh. And I think like you have to kind of be like doing what other people haven't thought of yet in order to make yourself stand out, especially as someone that's like young and doesn't have a track record already and not using that past record to continuously get more business. You have to figure out a way to differentiate yourself. Yeah. So I think in any field, even in OnlyFans, like the one that makes the most money, they're probably doing something crazy that's different from everyone else.
Welcome to the United States. I mean, like, hey, that's like taxable income, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know they're not going to be a burden. But like, and that's the thing that we need to like, future generation feeling hopeless. I think like hearing about being creative is very, very important.
So last question. When people look at you as the first of the family, what do you hope they remember?
Yeah, I think I hope that they see me as like a leader. I think that in my family, you know, I was always taught to kind of not stand out too much. Maybe like you could, of course, voice your opinion, but like don't, you know, kind of just fit within the rules and be in the status quo. And so entrepreneurship is not really something that I ever thought I would step into. And taking on all these leadership roles, owning my own brokerage and company is really not something that I thought I would do. So I hope that they remember me as an inspirational leader.
That's amazing. So in your family, you're the first of the family to be an entrepreneur.
Yes, to be an entrepreneur and to really take on leadership roles at any kind of organization or company. Yeah.
That's quite amazing. Thank you so much for coming on. I think this is a very inspirational episode and you can literally take a lot of the lessons that you shared and go run with it. I think it's like right there as the playbooks are laid out.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the First of the Family podcast. We hope today's conversation left you feeling inspired and maybe even equipped with one idea you can take with you as you turn earned income into own income and build something that actually lasts. If today's conversation resonates, here's how you can support the show and help it reach more families, investors, and entrepreneurs who are creating a lasting legacy. Hit follow and share this episode with someone who's thinking beyond themselves and into generations after them. And if you're feeling generous, leave a review. It means more than you know. Those few words help the right listeners find these conversations right when they need it most. By doing this, you're helping families build legacy, certainty, and continuity. For show notes, links, and resources from today's episode, head to thekittysisters.com.